You may proceed, sir.
Your Honor, Richard Cotty, registration 12345, on behalf of Leonard Sanderson. We're only here, excuse my voice, because of the rule of law and how insurance companies handle first-party claims. And when we all make a claim, we should be told why the claim is being denied. We have rules, we're asking that the rules apply uniformly and not have any exceptions. What we have here is the insured asking for the benefits, not being given any explanation for the denial. Going through the contractual remedies, still not being told why the claim was not being denied. Summary judgment being issued when he was being asked for an explanation. The judge misapplying, the trial court misapplying the former no-fault offsets, and that's why we're here. I have trouble harmonizing, as you may, a variety of cases on whether it's fairly debatable as a matter of law, or whether a jury should decide if an insurance company's behavior in denying a claim without any explanation is unreasonable. The trial court concluded whether a claim is fairly debatable as a matter of law, and juries don't get to make that decision, even though there's undisputed violations of the industry standards and practices as set forth by two affidavits. So we're here, I'm asking for guidance on how insurance claims should be handled in Colorado. We don't believe there should be the absolute cone of silence by the insurance industry over a first-party claim. So in every first-party claim, whenever we ask for our benefits, are we greeted with silence? So we don't know how to perfect our proof of loss. We don't know what else to put in. We don't know any defects. We don't know why the claim is being rejected.
Mr. Cotty, if I may interrupt you, I want to make sure I understand the chronology here. The first suit, the underlying suit, if you will, between the drivers got settled. There was a stipulated motion to dismiss. If I recall this right, you filed a demand for arbitration or sent a demand 2 days later. And then the dismissal of the underlying case happened, I think, maybe two weeks after that. So I guess my question is, you say you're entitled to an explanation. At what point are we talking about? It seems to me with only two, you've got the settlement and then 2 days later you've demanded arbitration. Is it true that basically all of the discussions that you say should have happened in the context of the arbitration proceeding between your client and the insurer?
No, Your Honor. This was not a 48-hour ransom note tendered by the insured to the carrier. The notice of the claim was submitted months and months before. Information was provided to the carrier, including medical bills, surgical bills, undisputed medical evidence indicating the damages far exceeding the $25,000 of underlying limits and far exceeding the underinsured motorist limits of $75,000. So the carrier had months and months of time to conduct an evaluation and investigate as the statutes require.
But this is during the underlying lawsuit you provided this year, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, and is there anything in the record? I have to say the record on appeal is fairly skimpy in this case, and it's troubling to me, and it was difficult. Let me ask you just objectively, is that in the record? Do we have anything in the record that tells us when you provided this information?
I will look to the affidavits from the experts, Robert Dietz and Diana Smith, the claim supervisors, not in this carrier, but from others, and also look in the attachments to the motions for summary judgment provided to Judge O'Hara. And that gives a chronology that the carrier wasn't ambushed by this claim. The carrier was being provided notice of the claim early on, being asked by Attorney Richard Eddington in those attachments to please evaluate, please investigate, please tell us why Dr. Kornman from Stedman Hawkins should be believed, or tell us why, at least to engage in a fair debate.
All right, now, and I will say, I may even have the affidavits here. I don't think there are any dates on it. And I think I tried to parse that through, but your memory is that the dates are in these affidavits. I'm talking about actual dates where I could figure out, you say they had months and months and months, but the best I could gather from my review of the record, it seemed like everything was happening while the arbitration was proceeding between your client and the insurer. So At best you can tell, it's just in at the affidavits and the summary judgment attachments is where I need to look?
I would look to the letters from Mr. Eddington, who was the attorney representing Mr. Sanderson.
Right.
And he's the one in his correspondence indicating to the carriers and providing all the information to the insurer for the conversation as to what the case is about and what else could be done. And that's the basis for it. But I don't remember, to be candid, if the dates specified in the affidavits.
I appreciate that. And Mr. Carter, if I could, since I have somewhat of the floor here, let me ask you, you said a lot in your first, in your opening statement. And it seems to me, I see three different issues, and please do correct me, there are three different big issues of concern. One is this, the insurance company said there was an issue of comparative fault in this case. Another one was there was an issue about whether we get a PIP offset or not. And then the third category is all the violations of the standards that you, the industry standards that you have referred to. If I could take the first two, I do not see or haven't seen anywhere in your briefs or in the record on my review that you actually dispute that there was a dispute about comparative fault and about the PIP limits. Is that true? You disagree with them, but there was a dispute about it, correct?
Yes, in our reply brief, Judge, we point out that the claim file, which we attached, never addresses this comparative negligence. This is an after-acquired thought raised by argument of counsel only to defeat the motion. But it was never asserted by the carrier as an explanation for why the claim had a value of what it did. So this is an after-acquired basis, Monday morning quarterbacking, if you will, by the carrier to legitimize why the claim then had a fair debatability when this was never articulated to the insurer.
But the carrier did try the issue, right? And the arbitrator said 15% fault to your client.
It was submitted for that.
And so
in claim handling, we have to go on what's in the file. And this was never in the file, nor was ever articulated as an explanation.
So is it your position that you had no idea they were contesting comparative fault?
Correct. Not until the arbitration itself.
And I keep saying you. I know you didn't try the case. Trial counsel.
Correct, Your Honor. That was a surprise. That was raised for the first time in the arbitration.
Okay.
Second issue on the PIP offsets, 10-4-706, Your Honor, provided $50,000 for medicals and $50,000 for rehab. Total PIP offsets under the old statute would have been $100,000. Judge O'Hara and American Family urged that the entire past and future medicals of $281,000 would be offset, which is incorrect. And because of that, Judge O'Hara concluded, well, we're only talking pain and suffering, fairly debatable. It's like throwing darts at a dartboard. Well, if you premise your analysis on a faulty misapplication of the law, he's accurate.
Can I ask you, you talked about those PIP limits. The PIP, the No Fault Act, sunset several months before this accident. How do those limits apply here?
That was the basis the carrier urged after the arbitration and during the arbitration to justify why the claim was worth less.
Well, they said, and I'm not arguing with you, of course, I'm just trying to make sure I understand. I understood they said there is an offset. I thought your client was the one who raised the limits issue, and in your appellate briefs here, you say, you look at the limits are $100,000, give them the benefit of the doubt, take out the $100,000, and the damages were still way above policy limits, as I understood it.
Correct.
Okay, so if that $100,000 doesn't apply, I think we would have to look at the limits actually in the policy, because there may be a contractual right. True?
If I follow you, Your Honor, the $75,000 underinsured motorist coverage was an issue.
I'm talking about the PIP limits now.
And the PIP limits, they were exhausted. So, and they can only be paid under the statute 10-4-706 if the carrier agrees that the amounts billed were reasonable and necessary and caused by the accident. And yet in the underinsured motorist, the carrier adopted an about face and said, we're not bound by that, which is another troubling issue. What insured Sanderson said is that even assuming there was a $100,000 offset, even assuming that to the benefit of the carrier, the outcome still dwarfed the amount of the limits without any explanation, leaving the insured frankly to guess at how the claim was being investigated and evaluated. And if I made the third point, I apologize.
You initially characterized this as a first-party claim. But isn't it really more in the nature of a third-party claim where now this insurance company steps in as the insurer for the other driver and can raise all the defenses and so forth available to that driver?
In Brecky, the court instructed that it has features of a third party, but it's not the same because in a third-party context, the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act doesn't apply. And in Dale versus Guarantee National, and in Goodson versus American Standard, the duties of good faith do apply during the pendency of the entire matter. And that's going back to my issue on rules. Do insurance companies get a free pass on rules? Should they have to comply or not? And that brings me to the Buchholz matter, which is the way I read Buchholz. There's no obligation to negotiate during the pendency of a first party uninsured motorist claim. We're not talking negotiation here. We're talking, what is the basis for the company's evaluation? How do we get there until we know what the materials are you've looked at? What can we do to get the full benefits of the coverage that we paid for and pre-funded with the premiums? Could I guess I'll just reserve the balance of the time, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is John Sands, and I represent American Family in this appeal. Respectfully, American Family is not looking for a free pass on the rules. And I think the facts are very important in this case. This really doesn't present anything new or novel to the court. It's very clear that there are no disputes about these facts. The insured here, the American Family's insured, made a liability claim against the other driver. And the law is, I think, pretty well established that the court case, the FAM case, and other cases that say that until that's resolved, there really isn't a UIM claim, effectively, because until you recover from the liable driver, there's no way to measure what you're legally entitled to recover, if anything, under your underinsured motorist coverage, and that's the basis for those decisions that we have briefed. Secondly, the other driver, Judge Gabriel, as you point out, defended that case for nearly a year or maybe even a little more than a year. But the point is there was a long period of time there where that driver, the other driver, Kelly Pierce, was contending she was not responsible for either the cause of the accident or the injuries being claimed as a result of that accident. During that period, American Family had the absolute right to await the outcome, effectively, of that action and determine whether underinsured motorist coverage was even triggered at all. And thirdly, and Judge Gabriel pointed this out, the demand for arbitration came almost immediately, and this thing went into arbitration on the underinsured motorist benefits right away. And so whether it was 2 days or a couple of weeks afterwards, it really is immaterial, respectfully, because the fact is it did go into arbitration right away. Really what is an issue in this case is whether American Family acted unreasonably and either knew or recklessly disregarded that it acted unreasonably. And I say that because the only claim raised before the trial court here in this case was a bad faith claim, one claim for relief. The underlying case had been resolved. So what the trial judge had to look at here was their evidence adduced by the plaintiff and presented by the plaintiff in the trial court here to show that American Family acted unreasonably and either knew or recklessly disregarded that it had. And on these facts, it respectfully submitted that there was no evidence from which the trial court could conclude that American Family did any of those things, because as a matter of law,
the argument seems to be that they only offered $30,000 when clearly they owed more.
But it's merely a dispute as to the value of a claim. And to say that clearly they owed more for For what? For general damages is really what it boils down to, because as far as I know, and they didn't cite any cases in their brief, any law, any from any jurisdiction, which simply so that because they say you owe more, or because they believe the evidence would show you owe more. There's one interesting passage in one of the cases that's cited in our brief, where, and it's not a Colorado case, but a court says, you know, assessing general damages, and we all know that a jury on one day can find one thing in a case, and you can try the same case with the same evidence the next day to the same jury and get a completely different result on something like general damages for pain and suffering and non-economic losses. And so I understand their argument is, you should have read all of this material and agreed with us that you owe more. But that, there's no law to support that it is unreasonable conduct on the part of an insurance company, and certainly not knowingly unreasonable or recklessly unreasonable, to disagree on that point. Mere disagreements as to valuation do not give rise to a bad faith claim or to a finding of unreasonable conduct. And
but is there a duty on the part of the insurance company, as counsel appears to argue, that you must now explain to us why the claim is only worth $30,000?
I don't believe so. I think that an insurance company has a duty. Well, on the facts of this case, where it goes into arbitration right away, effectively what would be happening, if accepting and following their argument through to its logical conclusion, an insurance company could not defend itself in an arbitration like this without giving up all of its work product and its attorneys' evaluations and things like that. And I think an insurance company has an equal right to defend itself in an arbitration proceeding or a lawsuit as any other party does. And so, again, following that argument through to its conclusion to set out what the thought processes are in defending itself. And Judge Roy, let me add this. You asked the question of Mr. Cotty, doesn't the insurance company step into the shoes of the other driver, and isn't the insurance company then allowed to assert all of the defenses that were available to the at-fault driver? And the answer is clearly yes. The Supreme Court has said so in the Brecky case. And so to say, well, notwithstanding the fact that someone has instituted an adversary proceeding against you as a party, insurance company, you have this duty to disclose whatever your thought processes are, the work product of your counsel, because you have a duty to explain to us the basis of your opinion, of your decision, or why you're contesting this, or why you're challenging the amount of general damages. And so respectfully, my answer to the question is no, that there is no duty to say, you know, here is how we interpret these doctor's records. I think there is a duty to tell the insured what the decision is. We disagree on causation. We disagree on your numbers. Beyond, and I think that happened here. There is a letter that's attached to our brief from counsel to counsel saying, here is what the issues are in this arbitration. And I don't think there's a duty beyond that.
Mr. Sands, let me ask you this. What kind of evidence could Mr. Sanderson, was it Mr. or Ms.?
Mr.
Sanderson have submitted in response to your client's motion for summary judgment to be able to survive entry of summary judgment?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know what it would be on these facts.
Well, let's just take a hypothetical. I mean, what kind of evidence other than saying our injuries were far beyond what the coverage was, so you should have paid us. What other evidence could they have submitted to show bad faith?
Given that the underlying UIM claim really didn't even mature until the settlement of the underlying case, and then it went virtually immediately into adversary arbitration proceedings, I don't know what it possibly would have been that they could have conferred with to say American Family acted unreasonably on these facts. And that's why I say I don't think this case presents a particularly novel issue, because this is a very fact-specific case. And so I have actually tried to come up with what that evidence might be, but given the law as it existed at the time, and I think exists today, American Family had the absolute right to await the outcome of the underlying liability case, and then to defend itself in the arbitration, and it did those things.
Mr. Sands, can I ask you, and maybe I just need to understand your framework, and I'll be very candid with you. I have a lot of concern with adopting a rule that says fair debatability is the beginning and the end of the analysis. I am struck by the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling in Zillish on that point. I mean, they say, not the be-all and end-all, you still have to act reasonably, even in a litigation context. So, for example, it would seem to me, although you say it's not this case and may be right, if you came to see facts in the course of the case that suggested you had no defense, I don't think that an insurance company can keep litigating, as I understand the cases. So that may be a hypothetical, you would say, to Judge Hawthorne. But I would like you to respond, if you would, to, you know, what is the basis for saying that fair debatability ends the analysis? I mean, I think you have to, you say I had a PIP offset argument that may have gotten me to less than limits. I had an argument about comparative fault that may have gotten me to less than limits or to nothing, and therefore I'm entitled to litigate, end of story. But it seems to me there has to be a reasonable basis to have those first two before you can litigate. I just posited that. Now explain to me why I'm wrong.
On this case?
On any case, sorry, I'm asking about the general framework. The district court seems to me say, if it's fairly debatable, if there's any issue in the world that's fairly debatable, end of story. You seem to be taking that very strong position, and you get a strong reaction from the CTLA and from Mr. Sanderson. Fair debate, there's no fair debatability standard, it's a factor. And I'm trying to understand where this fair debatability comes from as the be-all and end-all, because I don't see that in the cases.
It's a defense to a bad faith claim. And I'm not suggesting that it is the be-all and end-all in every file by any means, or on every case by any means. I think that there are those cases, for example, a relative uniformity throughout the country on the valuation of a valuation dispute, typically found fairly debatable. On the facts of this case, there were numerous reasons that the claim was fairly debatable. Are there those files where there's a bad faith claim that can be raised and fair debatability is not a defense on those cases? I'm sure there are. On this file, respectfully, I think no.
I'm sorry.
I think that's why I say this. On the facts of this case, I think that Judge O'Hara's opinion is certainly applicable across the board, because there were so many bases upon which this particular claim was fairly debatable.
Can you tell me how then you distinguish Zillish? I mean, Zillish, the facts were strikingly similar here, and Zillish says this is a fact question because they put on the same kind of evidence. It was a lowball settlement offer. It was you had a business plan to deny claims and raise profits. There was a whole bunch of things like that, and certainly Mr. Sanderson puts on some of that evidence here. So how is that, you know, distinguishable?
Well, I actually distinguished the Zillish case in the brief at page 24. And, you know, Zillish is I've seen it thrown around a lot in Colorado. But here's what, you know, first of all, Zillish, Arizona law apparently is that there is some sort of fiduciary, quasi-fiduciary relationship. Colorado, that's not true. We now know that that is the case. Based on the Broder and the Olson opinions, and I think it's an isolated decision, one court upholding one trial decision. Are there some factual similarities? I think there are some factual similarities, but that doesn't mean that, for example, in this case where we have the clear liability debate and dispute, where you have this issue of. By the way, I need to add this. I attached a copy of the Thomas opinion, not as binding authority or even precedent, rather to show that the state of the law at the time on this issue of double recovery of the PIP benefits
was a question that deserved, that American Family deserved to arbitrate, because I took that, you know, I defended that case in the Court of Appeals, and another panel said, you don't get to double recover because of the Quinones case, which long preceded any of this. It was a 1990s case. So I think that's another distinction that we have, that issue unique to Colorado, the Colorado PIP-UIM relationship and offset issues.
So your argument really is, if I'm understanding, and please do correct me, that you had a legitimate argument on comparative fault, you had a legitimate argument on PIP offset based on what you just said, the law was unsettled, and you had, I think your position is the insurance company had the right to litigate that once it had a good faith basis to litigate it, even though there was some evidence out there that, boy, the damages could get high if we're wrong.
It could be, yes, but is it unreasonable and knowingly or recklessly unreasonable conduct to say, there's a possibility we could lose this? If that's the case, then we might as well all surrender our law licenses, because none of us is a good enough prognosticator to predict what juries or finders of fact are going to do on injury cases.
But the case would be, and the case would be different, I suppose, if you did not, if there was an argument you did not have a good faith basis to argue about comparative fault and the PIP offset, then perhaps they would have an argument.
Maybe, but there's a third component of the debatability issue that I argued, and that is general damages are also subject to that same issue if it's a valuation dispute. So if that was the only issue in a case, for example, whether we paid enough or not or offered enough or not, that's fairly debatable. So there really are three components in my last 50 seconds here. Again, this issue of, in this particular case, the facts of this case, the liability of the tortfeasor, and the relative fault of the tortfeasor and the insured, what to do with double recovery of the medical bills, and thirdly, this issue of what are general damages worth. And in the end, the issue before the trial court is, given the facts of this case, did American Family act unreasonably and know or recklessly disregarded that it acted unreasonably? And we respectfully request that the summary judgment be affirmed, and thank you very much.
We have just under 4 minutes.
I'll donate a minute to Mr. Sands as well, because he and I go back so long, and I respect his opinion. The Thomas case came out 6 months after the arbitration award, so the panel didn't have the insights or the gift of knowing the future, so they couldn't predict what the court would say. Ignoring the general damages, Your Honor, just look at the medical damages. Those dwarf what the policy limits were, and it was undisputed.
If I can interrupt you, Mr. Cotty, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Sands. So as best that I can put this case together, let's take this as a hypothetical, because I know you disagree with it, that there is a legitimate good faith basis to argue about comparative fault, and there is a good faith basis to argue the PIP offset. Let's take general damages out. And you have all the evidence you have on your experts. It seems to me all those expert reports would not at all affect this issue about comparative fault or the PIP offset. They may, if they lose those, they may get hammered on damages, but it seems to me the expert reports really go to a dispute as to the potential liability. They don't seem to undermine the good faith basis for comparative fault or PIP. First of all, do you disagree with me, and feel free, of course, to disagree with me, but if that's right, why isn't it good faith as a matter of law for them to have litigated?
If they would have articulated that to the insured, then the insured would have an understanding. None of that was ever raised. Not once. The only thing raised was a letter from defense counsel, Mr. Ballard, saying that, well, the value is $30,000 because of his pre-existing condition. Okay, what does that mean in the context of the orthopedic surgeon saying he aggravated his pre-existing condition? And given my age, I'm glad I have a pre-existing condition. But in the law, what does that really mean in damages? Again, it doesn't generate any light whatsoever. So if there can be a reasonable basis to argue it, please let the insured know. That way we don't invite needless litigation for the insureds to find out after the suit's filed, oh, that's how you arrived at it. Had the insured known, perhaps the insured could have supplemented the proof of loss and we move on.
But don't we have to look at the context? You said initially at a $75,000 demand, their $30,000 response, as I recall, was this is our last offer, $75,000, last, you know, final demand. And they come back and say, in the context of a negotiation of a lawsuit, 30 grand, and they didn't mention PIP, I think, the offset issue in their letter. Now, you've mentioned yourself that they had no duty to negotiate. If they had no duty to negotiate at all, why did they have a duty to explain?
Because the Unfair Claim Practices Act doesn't give any free pass to carriers. The court says the laws apply during the pendency of this. There's no exceptions for it. And Buchholz, again, is overread for the obligation that, oh, you can't negotiate. Nobody's asking to negotiate. How do you arrive at your value? That's an explanation being asked for, not simply, oh, we agree on the same set of facts, and then I think it's worth A, you think it's worth B.
And so the litigation context, from your perspective, they have to explain it even though they're in litigation.
What the courts say. So otherwise, like an on-off case, the carrier says it's worth a buck, you go, it's worth more because it's not my arm. That's what we have. We ask that the Savio standard be applying here, Your Honors. Please let it go back to the court, trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.